Right. Commissioner Mackinson will now ask you some questions.
Good morning, Mr. Garrett Walker. Thanks for your time today. You mentioned that, I think, paragraph 10.9 of your evidence that there may be potential during detailed design to minimise the length of pipe streams. And I was just wondering on what opportunities you see in the current site layout, which we understand is reasonably well fixed for that, particularly given Mr. Leahy's comments yesterday around not really seeing an opportunity to do anything with the Severn Stream at this point.
My understanding, and this has been conveyed to me from the engineers, primarily Mr. Leahy, also Mr. Skelton, is that currently it's taken a conservative approach in terms of culvert length, and the idea is that during the detailed design phase, the culverts won't get any longer, but opportunities will be explored to make them shorter. And where that is the case, it would be my preference that they're not just, let's say, left alone, untouched, remain as is where is, but can then be seen as an opportunity to enhance and form part of the wider mitigation and offset package that will be developed at that detailed design phase.
I'm not sure if that quite answers my question. I'm interested in where that opportunity might arise. I mean, I understand that there is detailed design to go through and that you would like to shorten the length of culverts where you can. I'm just struggling to see where that might actually happen.
Yeah, right. I can't answer that. That would be as part of the engineer aspects of the engineering aspects of the design.
Another question I have is around a response to one of the submitter concerns about loss of vegetation across site, which you've typified as largely shelter belts, pasture, whether it's active or somebody's backyard, I think is probably immaterial at this point. And you talk about there being opportunities for native planting on site to give ecological benefit. I was just wondering whether you'd had any input into the landscape plan in terms of the types of proposed vegetation, how it's actually planned to give that ecological benefit, particularly given your comment around the existing native species basically being garden.
I wasn't directly involved in the determining the proposed planting mix and or locations, because that's largely driven by the landscape visual amenity effects and mitigating those effects. It was more acknowledgement that those landscaping aspects will inadvertently almost provide ecological opportunities that aren't driven by ecology effects decision, but will inherently provide habitat for birds, for and where possible, you know, riparian benefits to the streams and the like. So through the process, I was aware of the landscaping proposals, and nothing struck me as being at odds with that acknowledgement that it would provide inadvertent benefits.
Thank you. I also have a question, and this may be quite basic, about what is the importance of identifying hydric soils as part of your assessment of what is or is not a wetland. And what is a hydric soil?
That's the wetland in a broad sense, and we focused on the vegetation component earlier, but identifying and delineating wetlands is a stepwise process that goes beyond vegetation. There is acknowledgement in the Clarkson 2013 method and wider ecological understanding that there are limitations with that in it, especially when, I'll take a step back. So you start with a vegetation, a broad visual rapid vegetation assessment. And the idea is you can clearly locate wetlands that are obvious. You don't need to dive a bit deeper to confirm that. In the areas, or conversely, upland areas that are clearly not, dive a bit deeper. You start with a vegetation assessment that combines the species present with the cover they provide to the given feature, crunch some numbers, and that produces a dominance score and a prevalence score, and that's based on the species affiliation to wet soils. There is still, as part of that, if it's obviously a wetland, you stop there, you acknowledge it's a wetland. If there's still ambiguity, you step down into the next area, which is the hydric soils component. And that is, hydric soils are soils that are evidently affected by wet conditions. And that might be, obvious one would be peat, that is partially decomposed organic material, retains a lot of moisture. Other aspects are glade soils, or soils that have what they call mottles, and that's a feature that indicates there's potential water residing quite high in the soil profile, and then it's slowly percolating through the soils and can create or alter the iron component of soils as it does that, and you can see features that resemble a sort of a mottled profile. And the idea is that you can clearly, at that point, if it's evidently a hydric soil, you then step out of that process and you identify it as a wetland. And then recently, I understand, and this wasn't present for the time of my surveys and subsequent assessment, is then if there is still ambiguity in the process, you then step down and consider the hydrology of the site. And at this stage, it's MFE have produced a hydrology tool for that component. I'm just not familiar with it. So it's the hydric soils just forms one stepwise component of the wetland identification process.
Thank you, that helps. Yeah, I was wondering what they were. Do you have a couple of other questions that stem from those already posed to you? And one is around that acknowledging that you haven't been able to access all of the site. If there is a natural wetland present, how does that actually affect the design? What are the steps you have to take to preserve that based on the NPSFM?
That's probably a planning question in terms of how the NPS is enacted. But from a broad sense at this stage, the idea was to confirm whether there are any ecologically sensitive features that would inherently influence the design at this stage.
And you were also asked about stormwater ponds and wetlands and how those as stormwater management features could provide that ecological value. And you explained that essentially nature is opportunistic and that in your mind there was also the potential for creating environmental and ecological offset around and integrated with those stormwater management features. Once again, this may be a planning question, but how do you see that actually playing out in the condition set as put forward at present? To capture that essence of what you envisage, you know, where would it fit in? How do we make sure that actually happens?
That, let Ms. Bell fully detail that, but in my experience that is typically a component and consideration of the regional consenting phase as you start detailing up the site and at that point consider the mitigation and offset package, the opportunities and therefore what is required to fulfill that.
And my last question goes back to Fish Passage, it got me.
It's today's knocking the mic, isn't it? It's, yeah.
It is. And you mentioned that the majority of native fish species, which is another one, in New Zealand are nocturnal. How does that apply to the species that you've identified and may be present in that particular strain? So the short fin eel and the crayfish.
Yes, they are primarily nocturnal. As nature likes to be, there's exceptions to every rule. So that's not to say eels and crayfish and the likes don't forage in or during daylight, but they are, as their default setting, shall we say, are nocturnal.
Thank you.
Thank you. So my questions come in two parts. The first is that I have some questions from somebody who I don't know, but it came through the administrator. And those are other person's questions, which I think are appropriate to ask you. And then there are my questions. So dealing with the first class, the person is referring you to your attachment, which is the wetland identification survey, section 4.2.2, which is shown as page 13 of your evidence on my electronic version.
Yes.
So if you refer to paragraph 1 of that section, the second sentence, you will see a statement of the predominance of species. The question is, what other trees, species of trees, were present but not predominant?
Testing my memory. There was, from my recollection, there was also Pittosporum there, Corphi, from memory. Yeah, but I can't recall in that detail, but I can confirm later.
If you wouldn't mind like. Just confirming that by an email or something, that would be fine. And paragraph 2 of that, you may have the same issue. Paragraph 2, which reads, you refer again to predominance, and the question is, did you observe whether that area was set aside? I'm not sure what that means, but I presume not an active pasture.
At the time of survey, there weren't any stock in or around that location.
Yeah.
But then we go back to some of those sort of contextual considerations that are presented in the summary, that it was still evidently a pasture-dominated environment that wasn't other than some of those planted species and the likes of blackberry encroachment wasn't inherently different to, let's say, the next paddock over or across the road and the likes of that. Yeah.
Thank you. So now turning to my questions. There's an interesting answer to a question of Commissioner Sweetman, where you talked about anthropocentric responses to ecological activity, if you like. And when you gave evidence that there is the potential for enhancement, from the unnatural features, are you suggesting that on your experience there can be an increase in abundance of flora and fauna compared with the baseline situation now?
Yes, with some with a helping hand.
Yes.
Yes, yes.
And so from an ecological point of view, which is concerned with abundance and resilience and functioning, based on that level of assessment, is it those indicators as opposed to our views of naturalness that could be important?
Yes. Yeah. From an ecological perspective, that takes quite a holistic approach. The considering resilience, diversity, context, and the likes. And if we can start to satisfy some of those matters, consider them, and then satisfy them, but we've produced a diverse or resilient habitat within that, if that answers your question. Yeah.
And some local authorities aim for enhancing ecological corridors as a particularly, for example, Palmerston City's had a long aspiration of ecological corridors because of the level of modification on the plain. Would those necessarily be created, in a sense, non-naturally to achieve that outcome?
Yes, because the landscape is so heavily modified as it currently stands. We're always working backwards from that. And Mr. Leahy touched on it yesterday. We can only ponder what the streams in his example once looked like, but we're now having to work backwards and provide, like the question about the natural stream and naturalness and stuff, we're having to artificially construct natural features that provide those key features that allow species to, in terms of corridors, move, but also as suitable stepping stones, rest places, stopovers as well. So it's not, I don't see it as just being a corridor use the fish as an example of a way through, but providing food sources and and the likes as well.
Yeah. Now, an answer, in your oral presentation, you expressed a view while deferring to Ms. Ballett on the ultimate question, that some of this ecological management planning, which is in the conditions, is better left to the regional consenting phase. Are you familiar with the One Plan?
Aspects of it, and such that I've had to consider?
My recollection is that it claims the lead on Indigenous biodiversity at the regional level. So it allocates that function to itself, the region council, even though there is an Indigenous biodiversity function in the Act for territorial authorities. And that it undertook an assessment of threatened ecosystems in Schedule E that trigger particular consenting requirements. Are you aware of any similar territorial authority provisions in the Palmerston North City Plan?
No.
Have you discussed with Ms. Bell the question, are the provisions in the One Plan sufficient from an ecological point of view to address the Indigenous biodiversity and in-stream values and so forth?
As they might relate to this territorial authority.
Implementing this project.
Yes, and such that she hasn't highlighted any barriers or notable hurdles.
Well, what I would like you to do before I just accept at face value your evidence about the desirability of dealing with it at the regional consenting phase is to satisfy yourself in discussion with Ms. Bell that the suite of provisions that contained in the One Plan are sufficient from your perspective to address the ecological and biodiversity issues that are at the heart of this case. So, and if you could just confirm you've done that and that exercise satisfies you, that would be helpful. The final point is at the regional consenting phase, which we have no knowledge how that will play out, it's conceivable that there will be requirements for compensation or offsetting either internally or externally of the site. Correct?
Yes.
And in ecological terms, the nature and extent of those requirements are fundamental to an assessment of the extent to which there are effects or not.
Yes.
Absent that sort of analysis, we're not in a position to assess at the detailed level what the ecological effects are here.
Yeah, correct.
So your assessment is at a higher level, broadly looking at the qualities and values that are present, and recognizing that there will be significant impacts, modification, is it your evidence that if there is a functional need to have this activity here, it is otherwise appropriate from an ecological point of view?
Yes, and such that there are no features that are prohibitive from an ecological perspective.
Yeah.
Yes, yes.
Okay.
And there won't be any detriment to sort of wider ecological... I don't believe there'll be any detriment to wider ecological... the wider ecological landscape, shall we say.
All right, that's fine. Thank you for your answers. A little bit of homework to do. Appreciate your evidence. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. Thanks.
Thank you, sir. I'll next call Mr. Havelt, Contaminated Land and Air Quality. Let's have a little swap here. Yes, I know. I know.
Sorry. No, that's a good point. Yeah. But I touch it in this region. Please. That's my region.
Yeah. Okay.
Welcome, Mr. Phelps.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioners, good morning to you. I'm going to, first of all, read my summary statement.
Thank you.
Which is headed up air quality and contaminated land, but I will actually touch on hazardous substances as well, because I came in as a bit of a tail end Charlie to clean up several areas in one hit.
Well, that's very self-deprecating of you.
Well... perhaps it belies my grey hair, and I sort of got a bit of knowledge about quite a few things. In my summary, I will start by noting that a preliminary site investigation, or PSI, has been undertaken at the freight hub, and it has identified at least two HAIL sites, which are closely adjacent to the site. HAIL, I should just spell out, you probably do know what that means, but it stands for Hazardous Activities and Industries List. And it's a Ministry for the Environment list of sites that are, or activities, sorry, that are considered to have the potential to contaminate soil by what goes on in those industrial activities. Other areas of contamination are also expected in a rural agricultural environment and may be encountered, including historic sheep dip and burn pad sites. I recommend a detailed site investigation, or DSI, be carried out prior to the commencement of construction activities as a means of identifying specific areas of soil contamination. And these matters are covered in conditions 33 and 34, and there is complete agreement between the council and KiwiRail on the wording of those conditions. Those two conditions. Moving on to construction, the site earthworks required for construction of the freight hub mean that emissions of dust during construction may be significant given local wind conditions and could give rise to nuisance effects, and or the emitted dust may include residual contamination. To manage these effects, I recommend a comprehensive set of measures to manage dust from construction be prepared as an important tool to manage and minimise dust from construction activities. Ms. Ryan, who is the Council's consultant on air quality matters, has recommended air quality monitoring and the establishment of a meteorological station. In my view, some form of monitoring is indeed appropriate, and I also support the establishment of the meteorological station. The purpose of this monitoring is to establish the effectiveness of management measures to mitigate dust emissions to air during construction. This in turn will require baseline monitoring before construction starts. I understand that these are matters that will be addressed through the bulk earthworks considerations at the regional consenting phase. Ms. Bell will address this further in her evidence. There is also the potential for dust contamination of roof rainwater collection systems for domestic supply. There are several management options available, including connection of residents to the domestic water supply system, the installation of first flush rainwater diversion systems, and bulk supply of potable water via tankers. KiwiRail has proposed condition 99, requiring the investigation of affected dwellings and options to manage these effects. The council has recommended minor amendments to condition 99, and I am generally comfortable with these amendments. Moving on to operation or operational matters. There is the potential for emissions to air from general locomotive and rolling stock activities and various commodities transported into, through and onwards from the freight hub. An operational air quality management plan has been recommended in the council officer's revised conditions. From a technical perspective, I support the ideas behind and the proposed content of this operational air quality management plan. However, as Ms. Bell will address, I understand that these are matters to be addressed through the regional consenting process. However, there is the potential for operational activities, such as activities within the log yard, for example, to give rise to dust and particulate emissions. For the avoidance of doubt, an operational dust management plan has been included in KiwiRail's proposed condition 96, and I support the matter set out in the condition, in that condition. Hazardous substances. The potential operational effects of the freight hub include ground contamination by fuels, oils, and greases. Specific compliance requirements for the on-site storage and use of hazardous substances at the freight hub site have also been identified and recommended. These requirements are set out in detail in relevant New Zealand legislation for the workplace control of hazardous substances. In particular, that's the Health and Safety at Work, in brackets, Hazardous Substances Regulations 2017, which in turn reference various New Zealand and international standards to provide compliance yardsticks. KiwiRail must comply with these relevant legislative requirements to thus have the proposed hazardous substances facilities achieve compliance certification. Overall, I am confident that any adverse effects relating to contamination, air quality, and hazardous substances can be appropriately and reasonably managed. That's the end of my summary statement, sir. I just want to add some observations that I made on a site visit, which may be are relevant, I believe. I mean, we've heard so far about how it's a diverse and highly modified area, and I'd never been to the site before, and that was the first thing that struck me is the extent of modification and how diverse it is. And it's a very large site at 177 hectares. I was with Mr. Leahy doing the site visit, and he was so helpful in terms of pointing features out because he knows the site well. And he pointed to the other, we were on one side of the site, I think at the bottom, so to speak, of the site there, in that view.
The southern side.
Yes. And he pointed to the opposite boundary, and he said, there's that line of trees over there. Well, I can hardly see the line of trees. That gives you some idea, I think, of the scope. And you know that very well, of course. The other feature that I noted was it's surprisingly undulating. The extent of earthworks to level the site will be very significant. And, of course, we've heard about that from Mr. Skelton and others. I did note that I saw two above-ground farm fuel tanks, which piqued my interest. They're clearly diesel. And while I saw two, I'm sure there are a great many more. So when we come to do our DSI, detailed site investigation, in due course, I'm sure we'll be paying particular attention to those and other items of a like nature around farm sheds and where, for example, pesticide mixing activities may have taken place and matters of that nature. I also noticed in the site visit, which was in a car and it was actually raining, so we didn't get out and do any close observations, but there were buildings that were clearly asbestos cement roofed and the fascia of the buildings were also of a similar material. So when it comes to the initial stages of site development and demolition being obviously one of the first things that will be done, the careful removal of that material in line with the requirements of the asbestos regulations will be paramount, and that will really be an essential part, or not an essential part, but a key element of the construction management plan, which is condition 59. I've got some notes, so you're probably going to get to this anyway, but about first flush rainwater diversion systems. I wondered if it might be appropriate to present those now.
Yes. Okay. I did apologise. I called you Mr. Havel, and it should have been Dr. Havel.
It should have been, but that's all right, sir. We don't stand on ceremony.
Well,
you,
it is
you and I have appeared before each other before, I think. I've appeared before.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I'm sorry, I forgot.
No, that's okay. Absolutely okay. The first flush rainwater diverters, and I apologise for using trade names here, but the Marley system, if you Google it, you'll see a really impressive setup. And it's not expensive either. In the Marley system, you have leaf and debris diverters. Then you fit the diverter system itself. You attach your insect screens. I suppose you don't want wasps and bees going into your water. And then Marley have a vacuum kit, which attaches to the bottom of the tank and sucks out the very, very fine dust, which will gradually sink to the bottom of the rainwater collection over time. And I thought that was pretty impressive. And it only diverts, this surprised me, 40 litres per 100 square metres of roof area. That's considered to be a sufficient first flush. And I guess that's based on measurements that have been made over time, as that's an adequate amount of contaminated water to discharge. Prices, you can get not the Marley system, you can get a very basic-looking system, which is touted as very good, but I'm not sure it would be, for $70. The Marley system is more like $500. But even then, it's not expensive, I wouldn't have thought, in the scheme of things. And it may well be that when we are able to visit residences that have the rainwater collection systems, they rely on them, we may well find that some of them already have these systems installed. I wouldn't be at all surprised. But I could add too, sir, that Mr. Skelton, he has a lifestyle property in Whanganui, and he has rainwater tanks. He relies on rainwater tanks. He doesn't have any sort of diversion system. He filters out what he calls the coarse twigs, and he just lets the rest sort of accumulate in his tank. And he says
that explains a lot.
I'm sure. Well, he loves, and I'm sure people who have rainwater collection would love this too. The soft water is the thing that's appealing in terms of bathing and so on.
Well, the on that, like the for my sins, I've done quarries in Yaldhurst and Christchurch, where dust has been a significant, very significant issue. But it's the nature of the material and the conditions that are being won that is also a critical component.
Very dry and gravelly.
It's Wamakariri historical
riverbed.
But in terms of this exercise, this site, it's somewhat different, even though it's very substantial earthworks.
Yes. The other feature of that, I think, is that the earthworks will be done in stages. And again, we've heard about that from Mr. Skelton as well. Areas of land will be opened up, so to speak, and levelled and whatever. And then they'll be often, anyway, left to lie for some time before any further development activity takes place on that particular area. Now, it's not appropriate to leave that area, not appropriate to have no mitigation applied to that area. What can be done is you can spray dust suppression agents, for example. And the classic one is a very dilute solution of PVA glue, of all things, and that's widely used. as a dust suppression. You can't, because it's biodegradable, it won't last forever. So every 3 months you may have to replenish it again by respraying. But that's a really effective temporary solution. And that's what I would, in the fine detail of dust management, when we come to that, that's what I would have. The more permanent but still temporary approaches to hydro seed bare areas, if they're going to be left undeveloped, say for 2 years or something of that order, you would hydro seed rather than use your dust suppression PVA, because it just doesn't make sense to be keep going back every 3 months to replenish your PVA.
No, so it's absolutely critical to make sure that the sites are not exposed for long periods of time.
Key. Totally.
Without some mitigation.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. Okay, sorry, too. That's all that I wanted to add, if you like, to my summary, so I'm now able to receive your questions.
All right, so I'll just ask my fellow commissioners.
Good afternoon, Dr. Hellevelt, and thank you for that. Scarily, I have quite a bit of experience with contaminated land and hazardous substances.
That's good.
So I'm
I like
not
that.
Going to ask you questions in that space. But I will in the air space, air discharge in particular. So I was just looking at Miss Bell's evidence where she says that she does not anticipate that a regional consent would be required for air discharge for any operational activities. So I'm interested in your perspective on that, and are you familiar with the Horizons 1 plan rules around discharges to air, and is it your opinion that consent would be required from the regional council?
I'm not a planner, so I may duck that question. As a scientist, I just want to see control over dust. Now, what that takes the form of is the matter of fine detail that interests me, and matters of plan provisions and so on or requirements for plans and under whose jurisdiction they sit is of less interest.
So you just mentioned you were concerned about the control of dust, but how about other particulates?
Yes, absolutely, as well, yes. Oh, yeah. Dust is a nominal term for fine material, particulate, such as what may be generated and probably will be generated at the log yard is a different beast. Typically, maybe it's useful to talk about that now. At the log yard, if there's extraneous bits of bark and so on the logs, inevitably in movement of those logs, and even when they're static and stacked and so on, under high winds, that those particles will be blown off the logs. They won't travel a great distance perhaps, but if they're light parts of bark particles, they could. And so that is something that the siting of the log yard in the central part of the site is critical for.
Yeah, now, understand that in terms of what can be generated from the logs, but how about from other activities on the site, such as the diesel and
well, the black emissions from a poorly tuned diesel locomotive will not travel a great distance. 50 metres, something of that order. Quite fine particulate, but they won't travel that far. Mm. And a well-tuned diesel engine, as we hope might be present, will not emit anything significant.
What other particulates might be generated from the site?
Well, the passage of wind over the ballast, surprisingly perhaps, will actually generate possibly more dust than particulate if you want to
differentiate between
them. But that is something that's often not given due accord. So keeping your ballast clean, so to speak, is important. So, you know, I